Tonight, I thought we'd talk about socialism and morality, that favourite old chestnut, in a way. So, what could I say about socialism and morality? And I don't know about people here, but I have actually known members who joined the party because they were attracted by the intellectual rigour and the elegance of the case. And in one instance, because they just liked winning arguments, and they looked around at all the various theoretical perspectives out there and decided the socialist case offered the best chance of winning those arguments. Well, I found that a pretty cold-blooded kind of motivation, to be honest. I don't think it describes most of us either, from what I can see, because what gets us worked up, what gets our kind of motors running, our danders up, if you like, is, I think, an emotional reaction against the perceived injustice in the world. And to my mind, that makes perfect sense. When you think about every single story you've ever heard, ever since you were even a small child, in some way or other, it's a morality tale where wrongs are righted, crimes are punished, virtues rewarded, and somehow the cosmic balance is restored. This is what we do. We're a story-creating animal. So stories are how we construct our reality and our identities. Our culture is absolutely drenched in stories. And all of them tell us the same thing. It gives us this normative message. This is right. This is just. This is how things ought to be. And then we discover that it's all a lie and that what really goes on in the world is just the opposite. Capitalism is the opposite of just. The bad guys win, nice guys finish last, the innocent suffer. Justice is a fairy story, just like Santa Claus. And that discovery enrages and offends people. It violates every precept of our moral programming. So it's not just when we encounter the world out there and its departure from our normative program, it's not just a cognitive dissonance, it's also an emotional dissonance. Something that should be symmetrical is constantly out of whack. We can't help reacting viscerally to that. It's a bit like getting seasick when the floor keeps tilting under you. Now, if you ask most members why they're socialists, their default position is to talk about the bad shit that's out there, you know, capitalism. But that's not the real reason. The real reason is the bad shit they feel inside, their emotional reaction to that stuff out there. That emotional dissonance, that moral rage is the sort of fuel that drives people to action. But the weird thing in our party is that we downplay emotion. We want to avoid making moral statements and moral arguments. Now, this is perfectly fair and justifiable to do this. We know that morality is mutable. It means different things to different people in different places and at different times. It's constantly evolving. It's no good as a common language that you can make yourself understood in. If you want to communicate with all people in all places in a common language, that has to be the language of evidence and observable fact. That's why we avoid morality in favour of rational argument. But what I want to suggest tonight is that it's possible to go too far. It's not easy, and arguably it's even impossible for humans to act as purely rational creatures. But we kind of convince ourselves that that's what we've done, that's what we are. And that's why we tend to write in quite dispassionate, objective terms. We claim to be scientific, or at least aspire to be scientific. In particular, we refuse to allow anyone to join the party who has irrational beliefs. Although it seems to me that this overlooks the fact that the very idea that we are perfectly rational creatures is itself an irrational belief. Now, some members will remember that we had a debate some years ago in the party, which led to a party poll on the question whether the socialist case was in part an ethical case. I'm going to use the words ethical and moral interchangeably because I'm not really sure what they mean. So I'm sure someone can tell me. Anyway, the membership voted against this idea. I suspect, because it wasn't true, but more out of a fear that of potential ramifications if the statement was allowed to stand. So, the socialist case is ethically motivated. I think we can fairly say that. Never mind what our official position might be. Socialist standard writers and pamphlet writers sort of learn to avoid using appeals to moral concepts like justice. And they try to, on the whole, write in a kind of dispassionate, objective style that it might appeal to academics and left-wing scholars, but I can't help thinking doesn't appeal to the majority of workers out in the world who don't think like that and they don't talk like that. And it's actually quite funny because when you look at the writings of earlier generations in the party and even William Morris and Marx and Engels themselves, you see how the text is often on fire with a sort of palpable moral outrage. It just blazes off the page at you sometimes. Someone recently acquired for me the SPGB's 1905 manifesto, which is pretty hot stuff. And the 1920 preface to the reprint of this rages against the recent war and the betrayal of the international by the European pseudo-socialists. The language of it practically burnt my finger ends. It was riveting stuff, quite inspiring. Now, I'm not saying we should therefore revert to tub-thumping Edwardian hyperbole, but I do miss a bit of passion in standard articles, and I wonder why we seem so keen to pour cold or lukewarm water all over that emotional energy that most of us feel and train ourselves to write like bloodless accountants. So I'm not arguing for another party poll on the ethical question. I'm personally happy for the case to be based on rational, not moral arguments. So let me make that clear. But just to leave you with this one question, have we thrown out the baby with the bathwater? So anybody like me to take me up on any of that?
It's an important question, this, Paddy, and it's a pity there are so few of us here actually to talk about it. Because it's something that, arises quite a lot. It arises quite a lot when we talk about what's happening in the world. I mean, you only have to look at the party's Facebook page, for example, to see how concerned people get about these sort of various obvious injustices taking place in different parts of the world and indeed in this country. To know that it's something that, as you said, Paddy, sort of gets people viscerally. It also arises when people apply for membership. People sort of talk in emotional terms about what's happening in the world and, you know, why we need to have a different kind of world. So I don't think we obviously can't divorce morality or ethics, call it what you like, from the socialist case. The two sort of intermingle, don't they? Rationality and morality. And actually, there's no reason why they shouldn't. It wouldn't be good if somebody joined the party merely because they felt outraged about what was going on in the world and didn't know, you know, what we were about and what our alternative was. But once somebody does know that, there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't feel justifiably outraged by all the various things that capitalism does to people all over the world, incidentally, not just, you know, in the third world or whatever, but, in this, all the stuff that's coming up now, in this virus period, how certain categories of people, if you like, are being neglected and forgotten about and so on and so forth. Coincidentally, I should say, there's actually a program on the radio in about 15 minutes' time on Radio 4 about economics and morality, which apparently, though the trail says, argues that the idea that gets put about by the so-called neoliberals or libertarians that greed is good is completely alien to the way people actually think about themselves and others. Might be worth listening to. I don't know that program on BBC Sounds later.
I have to really agree with you, Paddy, on almost everything you said. I feel in a sort of interesting position here because that resolution that went on to the was actually voted at conference that socialism was both scientific and ethical, and it was actually Gwyn Thomas and I that kind of led the charge against it for the very reasons that you suggested, in that that statement was so ambiguous that it could be interpreted in so many different ways, many of which could be detrimental to the party case. And I just, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I think about it in a slightly different way. Morality is a hugely complex issue. I mean, it's a gigantic rabbit hole if you start to go down it academically or intellectually. I mean, you're very quickly coming out the other side in Australia and heading off towards Alpha Centauri. It is so complex. And that's the sort of thing that we really don't want to get ourselves tangled up in. So to try to provide a moral foundation for the socialist case would be absolutely disastrous. And that's why I spoke against that party resolution. But I absolutely also agree. We don't have to sort of sound like the front page of The Guardian, you know, this totally bloodless prose. The party case is a factual case. You know, we make our cases entirely factual. We don't claim that the capitalist class established capitalism from some moral considerations. But that in fact they were just pursuing their own interests. We found the party case on class interests. But as you said, you know, for a human being to accept any statement, they're going to make a value judgment about it. And you can't help making value judgments. And many of the value judgments that we might want to make are moral judgments or can be described as moral judgments. So there's absolutely nothing, to prevent us in expressing our outrage at the vast destruction caused by capitalist wars. There's absolutely nothing to stop us being outraged by that. What is the problem is trying to turn that into some kind of academic case. If you put your position to somebody, if you make the case to somebody, whether you put it in bloodless prose or whether you become very passionate about it, they are going to have to use their own judgment to decide whether they're going to accept it or not, their own value judgments. This, you know, if somebody doesn't actually think for some reason that the vast wars of capitalism are in any way problematic to them, say they don't value peace and that they are quite unmoved by all the suffering they cause, then it doesn't matter how passionate you get or how strong a case you make, they're not going to be moved by that. So all we need to do is we need to make the case, but there's no reason why we can't be passionate about it. What we have to avoid is trying to provide it with an intellectual framework, which can then be so easily undermined and drag us into all kinds of disputes, in terms of what morality is, that we really don't want to have to get engaged in.
Anybody wants to chip in, just do. We're not having a chair for the meeting. It's just an open free for all, really.
Yes, I'd like to say that that resolution that was overturned was worded very funny. You said socialism is both scientific and ethical. That's all it said. I couldn't see any reason to go against that. However, the year after, it was overturned on the basis that case for socialism is one of class interest, not one of morality. And I thought that was going off the subject. Ethical really means, well, wanting to have everybody on the planet having food, clothing, and shelter is unethical. To me, that's ethical. To do that, you have to be so-called scientific. But after 116 years, the fact that we get 0.1 to 0.2% of the vote cast in the election last year doesn't bode well for that. I think people get carried away with the scientific thing. We have a logical argument. Had a logical argument, it doesn't go anywhere. So, not, you know, the case for socialism is we need to have food, clothing, shelter for all the humans on the planet. And we live a peaceful life. It's an ethical way of doing it. The means to be scientific, but if you lose sight of that, people will ignore you and say, oh, well, you know, that's why we don't get many votes, one or two every 1,000 votes cast. It's not a good.
Mike, you really broke up a lot there. I couldn't make out a tail of what you were saying. Was it the same for everybody else?
No, I could hear all right.
Yeah, I could hear. I think it might maybe is your connection, Steve.
Okay.
It was very clear to me.
Sorry, okay, it's my connection, sorry.
See, I don't disagree with anything that you say, Mike. I absolutely agree. The only thing is that resolution was so ambiguous. It could be used in all kinds of ways, or it could be interpreted in all kinds of ways that would be detrimental to the party. I mean, it could be claimed that, for example, socialism was founded on a set of moral prescriptions. And if that was the case, the logical outcome of that is that you would have to be standing up on your platform or talking to people in the pub, telling them, pointing your finger at them, saying socialism is such that you have a moral obligation to defend it and to pursue it. Now that would be, I don't know how many people who might want to do that, but that would be a disastrous set of consequences. It could be interpreted in that way, and it could also be interpreted in ways which do drag us into all kinds of moral arguments. We actually have an ambiguous position as socialists over morality and over a great deal of other things as well, because in fact, we exist in one kind of society and we are advocating for another. So this is actually going to engage us in lots of contradictions of various kinds which we can't escape. So, for example, you know, as a comrade of mine, if you stole something from me, I would be morally outraged, yeah? But I would be applying capitalist morality because we live in a capitalist society. Yet at the same time, I am saying I'm quite happy that we actually take away the property of the capitalist class in order to introduce socialism. And there I'm actually applying a specifically socialist kind of reality, absolute morality. You know, these sorts of issues would come up and, have the potential to come up and bite us if we accepted that resolution. So I have no problem with what you're saying. I do have a big problem with that resolution.
I don't use the word morality at all, ever. I have an ethical belief system. I wouldn't use the word morality. I grew up in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s in Ireland, where morality, and in England, where morality was a name for repression. And I've lost that coming over here in the 60s and 70s. I lost any concept of morality, because it's something that the ruling class use, but where I wouldn't use it. We believe in ethics. People, food, clothing, shelter, medical. We believe in, but we have to get it. That's not morality. That's an ethical case. I have no problem with that. But I don't see all these logical arguments coming into being. Because, I don't actually see we have a logical argument for socialism. I wouldn't argue in logic. I would argue for reason.
Well, let me put it this way. So supposing somebody came up with to prove that human nature did exist. Let's just use this as a kind of a thought experiment, and that human beings were violent and warlike, and it didn't matter what kind of society we lived in, we would always be violent and warlike. If that was the case, then we would lose any kind of ethical claim against capitalism on that basis, that it actually produces war. So the claim that we actually make is that we can demonstrate that capitalism does produce its war, or at least we claim we have a justifiable argument for that. And then if we, once we've done that, then people can respond to that, you know, and say, okay, yeah, but, you know, it's the factual claim that makes our argument, not the moral or ethical one. I don't see any difference between it. I think, to be honest with you, I mean, for me, it would be nitpicking to distinguish between morality and ethics. But yeah, it's the factual case that we actually present that actually provokes a evaluative or moral response or ethical response in the other person who we're talking to, and actually draws them over to the socialist side. It's not, you know, the fact that we can. It's not the fact that, you know, we can just sort of be very moral about it that actually wins them over. It's the fact of the case that wins them over. But there's nothing to stop us being moral or ethical about it, or getting, you know, passionate about it, as Paddy said. There's a big difference between moral feeling and moral principles. That's what I was saying. Morality is a very complex thing, and it's very poorly defined. You know, so ethical principles, once you start getting into kind of that kind of argument, you're getting into a real big hornet's nest. But moral feeling, absolutely go for it. I'm really all for it.
Joel, can you just mute your mic, because we're getting a bit of background noise from you. If you're not planning to speak, just at the moment, thank you. I think Richard's dead right. I completely agree with that argument. As I said earlier, you know, I absolutely don't think that we should. Base the socialist case on any kind of moral edifice at all. But I do wonder though that, I'm sympathizing with what Mike's saying. If we're kind of sort of institutionally, in the party anyway, kind of institutionally a bit afraid of, moral positions, or, a bit unwilling to recognize the ethical dimension in what we do, fully recognizing that we're not going to make arguments on that, but that we are nearly all of us are motivated by some sort of, moral sense. But this ought to come through in our writing, in the way that we present ourselves. And somehow we seem to neutralize all of that, sterilize all the ethical side of our case out of it. And I don't think that's helpful. As I say, I mean, I think if we're trying to make our case relatable to people, I think we need to use the language that people use. And, people do talk in terms of ethics. What do people think about that? Are we deliberately avoiding it?
What sort of language are you thinking of, Paddy?
Well, can I give an example maybe of the kind of thing Paddy's referring to? It's funny how quite a bit of this really... I'm down to give a talk on Friday about religion, and it's a lot of this sort of does relate to that in certain ways. And what I'm going to mention, I'll mention it now, might as well, because it's relevant, is that in the course of receiving applications for membership online, via the party's website, one gets sort of all sorts of answers to the questions. And we're actually looking at the moment, one of the applications we're looking at the moment is somebody who describes himself as a non-theist Quaker. You know, there's a question on the in the questionnaire, which says, it's the last question actually, what are your views on religion and its relation to the party's case for socialism? And this applicant says that he's a non-theist Quaker. And I've got a quote from him here. He says, I believe in living in harmony with the environment, with other people who are all our equals, and with other countries. For to Quakers like me, countries need not exist. So he's looking at a sort of brotherhood stroke sisterhood of humanity. Pretty hard to resist, actually, because certainly that's the kind of thing we're looking for. Maybe we're coming at it from somewhere different, but nevertheless, you know, there's definitely a clear, what you might call, identity of aim here.
I understand that you can be non-religious or non-theist and be in the Quakers. I mean, any of us could be in the Quakers on that basis. So I'm not quite sure, Howard, what your committee is struggling over in that case. I can't see that would be a barrier to membership. But I remember years and years ago, I've probably told this story before, but I used to hitchhike around the country. And, one time I got a lift off a lorry driver who, we started talking about politics, and he said, oh, I'm not really interested in politics very much. And then he said, what I really want is a world without money and, you know, without nation states and, you know, where we share everything and there's no war. And I said, good heavens, you're not a member of the socialist, the SPGB, are you? And he went, no, he said, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. And, I was a bit taken aback. And, he said, the Jehovah's Witnesses believe that paradise isn't something in the sky that you get when you die if you're good. It's something that God's told us to build down here on earth while we're alive. And I thought I didn't want to bring up the question about the blood transfusions and piss him off. You know, he might kick me out at the next junction. But I thought I could probably live with that. You know, if I think that's the. That's quite a good motivation. I mean, I've heard much worse ones from religious people.
Well, there is quite an interesting history of the past from Leo Tolstoy all the way up until the modern day of religious socialism. Of course, it's grounded very differently than, say, the socialism of the SPGB, where it takes its idea of its striving for socialism entirely from a moral perspective of that religion. So Leo Tolstoy was specifically an anarchist, and he specifically stated that you can have a capitalist system and still be religious, and you couldn't. I don't know if anyone grew up religiously, but that you couldn't agree to the Nicene Creed, which is something that a lot of churches often will make you say, and also still be a Christian. In his mind, to be Christian was also to be socialist.
Yeah, we probably shouldn't pursue this line of discussion too far, or we'll end up rehearsing Howard's talk on Friday.
Well, one thing I wasn't going to say on Friday, so I'll say it now, because it's sort of the same kind of experience that Paddy has talked about with the lorry driver. You know, many years ago, we were putting up candidates in local elections in the area I live in. We went around knocking on doors. Local elections in fairly small areas, if you've got sufficient number of volunteers, people who are prepared to do it, you can knock on most of the doors, and various things may happen. You may get turned away, but you know, you do get involved in a certain number of conversations. And we were, you know, enthused that, yes, a fair number of people, on hearing what we said, for said, yes, I completely agree, etc., etc. But of those, quite a few, as you sort of went on in the conversation, it turned out they were religious in one way or another. Whether they actually finish up voting for us or not, I don't know. But presumably there were certain things about our case they weren't going to accept as a result. But nevertheless, it took me aback a bit because it was the first time I'd come across this really. And I think as I say, since being involved in the membership applications committee, looking at people's questionnaires, I mean that arises there as well to a fairly significant extent.
Yes, it does seem to be a bit of confusion that the party case, which is the SPGB and all its rules and regulations and procedures and resolutions, and the case for socialism, does seem to be quite a difference. I think it does seem to me this thing about religion in the party stems from, when Thijs was Christian, but that's long ago. There's not many Christians, real Christians around these days. You might go to the church or something, but a social thing, not a belief thing. There's few believers these days. Darwin has, a lot of people, a load of crap. Often the modern religions. But in the 60s and 70s, I came across a lot of people who were non-Christian. They may have been Christian or Jewish or whatever, but they just lost any belief in the supernatural. I don't think many people believe that these days. So I can't understand why it's like living in a time warp in some little sect sometimes, listening to party members. I always feel, but we're here to get everybody food, clothing, shelter, medical aid. Concentrate on that and the scientific way of doing it. You might get somewhere. You're just going to talk about, this, that, and the other, and look down on people because you think they might be religious, and that's that you used to look down on. Well, what are we going to do? I mean, look, I'm quite despairing at the moment because last week I read something on science, Earth's energy imbalance, and how it's been measured. It's a new scientific paper, but the implications of that for the population, world working class, and their descendants and their children and their grandchildren, they're quite grim. I'm slowly coming out of that really depressive view on that because I can infer what's going to likely happen to them. But to sit around talking about looking down on people because they're religious or whatever, it's unbelievable that, try to use the scientific argument, we'll use the moral. You call it, I call it an ethical argument of after people, living with people, and use the scientific way to get there. Don't confuse the two, because that's what I think is like an academic discussion. Rather than, we got to get somewhere, we got to get the world back. And it seems you got lost in point scoring of academics. Well, I wouldn't argue that. There isn't anybody that says humans are inherently violent. I know too much about archaeology to know that's crap. And most people who bear children, the people who train and raise and feed their children, and people who pass on that knowledge, they're the people who don't run the world. And that we've got to talk to them and communicate with them. And if you keep on the straight, we call scientific, inhuman, anything anywhere. Sorry, I'll probably try to get you on Friday about the religion bit. Sorry, I've heard to enter that a bit.
Yeah, I think second guessing Friday's discussion, that what always seems to happen with discussions about morality is that religion gets dragged into it because, of course, religious organizations have sort of tried to monopolize morality as if they're the only possible sources of it. And you've only got to look at the world today, you know, as Mike says, you know, religion is disappearing in this country, and the most secular societies in the world are probably in Scandinavia, and you know, we can all see for ourselves that they have not descended into barbarism at all. You know, they are highly ethical societies insofar as that's possible in capitalism. So we've kind of done it ourselves, haven't you, here tonight? We've kind of once again combined morality with religion. Those two things, I think we need to decouple, and they are being decoupled in the modern world anyway. But I also think that one other optimistic sign is that as religion has declined in advanced capitalist countries, you've not seen any equivalent decline in ethical values. In fact, those ethical values have continued to evolve. You only need to look at how sort of gay LGBT rights issues have evolved over the last 30 years, and how young people now don't see those as issues in the same way as they were seen 30 years ago. And not saying that it's the whole, that there are no problems, of course, but people's values today, you know, people like to make cracks about the snowflake generation. You know, my son's a member of this so-called snowflake generation, and his friends are. And from what I can tell, they're more sensitive to things that they're more more sensitive to things like jokes against other people, against other groups, races, genders, you know, sexual preferences and stuff like that. Those things are less and less tolerated by society now. And I think, you know, that's an encouraging sign. And, you know, people's, and just an almost trivial thing, you know, look at the change in attitudes to smoking in just the last, 10, 20 years. You know, to me, that's a sign that people's attitudes can change really quite dramatically in quite a short time. So, I don't see, and people's resentment against, you know, the big corporations that get away with paying no tax. I know that's not really a concern to us, but, Occupy movement was highly motivated by the fact that, you know, these huge companies weren't paying any tax. You know, those are sort of today's ethical considerations. So I think that there's still a strong sense right across the world of there ought to be fair play. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Belarus at the moment, here's a guy, Lukashenko, who was polling in pre-election opinion polls, he was polling 3% of the support. And when he rigged the election, he announced to the Belarusians that he'd won 80% of the vote, and they immediately revolted and in an uprising. And the same thing has happened in the eastern provinces of Russia because of what Putin's done to this popular opposition leader. He's had him poisoned, basically, it looks like. Putin's getting more and more isolated, and the popular objection to him is sort of, you know, ethical in its nature. You do not poison the opposition when they're in a democratic society. So I think there are lots of optimistic signs in the world.
Bit of devil's advocate, Paddy, maybe here. Well, everything you say is true, and a lot's been made recently of the fact that in the lockdown there was so much sort of mutual help between people. You know, people were helping one another in the best way they could, etc. And you know, it was being said that the world will never be the same again because of that. People realise how important their neighbours are, how important it is for people to help one another, so on and so forth. Well, that remains to be seen. There's all that. But at the same time, you've got these poor people trying to come over to Britain on boats from France, some of them drowning, others sort of managing to get over. And which has brought an absolute flood of bigotry on social media and elsewhere. People saying, "Let them drown," you know, "Who cares? They're taking what we should have," etc., etc. So, you know, it's certainly not one dimensional. This kind of thing. There are sort of, you know, tendencies pointing in the other direction as well. Okay, it's hard to know the extent to which they represent large numbers of people, but, you know, the impression you get is that they, you know, the there's a lot of it around, put it like that.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that ethical values don't prosper well in a climate of fear, which a lot of people are living in because of the pandemic, because of the global economic crash and, you know, severe insecurity over their own, you know, food, jobs, housing and all those things. So, yeah, people are having generally a bad time in capitalism. We know that. And so, you know, the fact that people have got any ethical sort of feel any ethical niceties at all is, I suppose, what I'm being optimistic about in the circumstances.
Just throw my two penny thing. I must say, I feel, although my response to capitalism as a youth was one of disgust, you know, utter disgust at what was going on in places like Nigeria and the Civil War in Vietnam and things like that. I'd be very, very reluctant to see us start to use this the arguments about morality. That for the simple reason is that we've got people could quite easily put to us, well, my morality is the equal of yours. I think we could avoid it. I think we should be talking about the insanity that we've got in capitalism. I think we ought to learn from what we've recently taken from Marx when he keeps going on about this insanity. I've forgotten the German word that you pointed out to us, Richard, about that Marx uses. But this is perfectly suited to us. We've got so I don't need to rehearse the insanity for us, but we ought to be pointing out to people, look, we've got this precarious situation where of our material well-being, and it's absolutely irrational. We shouldn't be having to put up with it because we can now produce an abundance. So I think that should be the argument, the insanity of using little metal tokens or paper tokens to distribute goods around. Yeah. I think we're better with rationality than this, than anything else. However, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't use, colourful prose, if we can, or blooded prose rather than cold-blooded prose. I definitely think that's a possibility. But I've seen things creeping in, for example, in discussions that we're having within the party about rights. Yeah? I don't see why we should be using words like rights. It quite plainly means nothing. You know, I've seen a party member mention children's rights just recently. Well, what the fuck are children's rights? What are human rights? These are things that have been put forward in a capitalist context. You look at the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. Right in the middle of it is the right to private property. I think this is something that I'm getting passionate. It's something that we should steer all the way from.
Surprise people have been saying that, Steve, in the party, talking about rights. Not something I've ever heard, I must say.
Well, just have a look at the arguments that we've been having recently about feminism or feminist.
Okay.
Can you not give us an exact quote, Steve? It's a very vague reference. Somebody might have vaguely used it, but I don't think you'd be reading into it what you... You know, something that you're afraid of. I mean, probably that Declaration of Human Rights property. Well, that's we most of that we agree with, but it's private property. This is what the key thing is. And concentrate on that, because people understand human rights is. Didn't have a right to vote in 100 years ago in this country. They have now, and it's a right. Be very careful about making vague. Somewhere in the party talking about children's rights, without exact reference, scientific way.
I'll tell you what, Mike. I'll find it for you and I'll post it to you. All right. And this idea about human rights, it's a load of bollocks, because human rights are life. How the fuck have we got human rights are life when we've got all these, we're threatened with nuclear war? It's absolute bollocks. And that's what we should be pointing out to people, instead of falling into the, we'll use rights because, well, we've now got the right to vote. Well, we've got the right to vote at the moment in this country. is that an eternal? Is that a universal? That's the sort of thing that we need to avoid.
Yeah, I agree about that quite strongly, really. I mean, I think there are two ways of talking about rights. There are the kind of rights that are given by a power to those not in power. So we have the right to vote. That's a legal right, and it's a material right because it's actually been given to us by somebody else. But then there's the kind of rights that people claim we have, but which are not established materially by any power with the authority to give rights to people. And, you know, these rights are entirely abstract, and they're entirely fished out of midair. And the other point is that those rights that are material rights that have been bestowed are often very ambiguous anyway. And certainly I agree with Steve on this, that in terms of like human rights, they are human rights that have been given from a capitalist perspective, such as the right to property and so on. So we need to be very careful about the language of rights, I agree.
Yeah, I agree as well. I mean, you've only got to look at the Americans' obsession with the right to bear arms to ask yourself, what do we mean by rights?
Quite simple. The right to everybody to have food, the right to everybody to have shelter, the right to everybody to have a peaceful life. Quite simple. But I can understand all your arguments about, we mustn't use these ones. But people understand these ones. We should be scientific about this and invent our own ways of describing what we mean socialism. Use our own brains to do that. It's easy to say, that's just the capitalist thing, we mustn't get involved with that. 0.1 to 0.2% of the votes cast tells me that that's wrong, and I want to try and do something about that. Because we have to get a world back before it's gone. If you really want to be made miserable, I could send you a link to this scientific report on the Earth's energy imbalance, and you could ponder on that, and then you'll say, stop playing around with vague arguments. Let's use our brains, what we want, express them to people who know and understand it. The right everybody to have food, easy to understand. The right to have everybody to have shelter, housing, is easy to understand. We have our own views on those and get them into people's brains. Most people would agree with those ideas.
Yeah, we don't need you to make us miserable, Mike. fair enough what you're saying about rights, but you're using it in a different way from the way it's normally used within capitalism. Nobody would possibly disagree with what you're saying about, for socialists, we want the right for people to be fed, clothed, sheltered adequately, et cetera, et cetera, and have a decent, comfortable life. But, you know, it's simply not the way the word is used normally within capitalism.
No, but the way the socialists can use it to distinguish themselves from capitalism.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
but there's no way of distinguishing between the right to bear arms and the right to have food. That's the problem. A right is a right. If you accept one, then you have to accept the possibility of the other. I mean, I think Howard put it just then. He said, you know, we want people to have the right you know, to have a material note. And that, put it that way, I wouldn't have so much objection to it. But to say that people do have the right is just like, I mean, Mike talked about vagueness. That is vague. I mean, where does this right come from? It's not something that you know, is, I mean, one of the things, if you look at the Declaration of Human Rights, one of the most difficult things in all of jurisprudence is trying to give some kind of meaningful definition of a human right. It causes no end of problems because it is, in fact, a complete, I was going to say nonsense. It's a complete invention. And, you know, it's, if you're going to establish that there are such things as abstract rights, then there's no end of rights that people could claim that we can't actually, which we wouldn't agree with. So yeah, let's talk about, if we have to, let's talk about, we want people to have certain rights, but don't let's sort of claim that these abstract rights exist as mysterious entities floating around in the universe, because they don't.
I thought that was the socialist case, to bring these into existence, change the world, a world where, well, won't be that the object, but all of you know it. I thought that was the reason for our existence, to try and bring this about.
Yeah, I agree.
And you using those, you know, using those terms would be understood by a lot of the population. But we have to get our own view of that, of course, rather than copy the ones that are in the capitalist constitutions. But we don't have to draw up a constitution. We have to keep them very simple. Food, clothing, shelter, medical aid, all that. And the other additional things that we have to do in the technological society. But we have to reclaim those. That's what all revolutions have done, is to claim and make a new consensus and consciousness of what includes and means by right. I wouldn't get involved with what the capitalists mean by right. I know they're only little reforms to keep them quiet. But we have to be strong and try and get our own views across, and this is what we have to put across. Do it in academic language, it won't work. You want me to repeat the number of votes we got? I don't think I need to start looking, though, but I'll be back on the scenario that I need.
I think that's a non sequitur, Mike, the trying to kind of tie up the number of votes. This is not an established fact that we only get that number of votes because we're not claiming that people ought to have rights. I think you need to establish that before you make that claim. But, you know, I don't agree. I don't disagree with anything you say. But all of that can be put forward without the language of rights. You know, we want people to have food. We want everyone to be fed, to have a decent home, to have a decent life, to be able to fulfill themselves. You know, we've been putting those points forward for a long, long time. We don't need to go into this very complex and very dubious area of talking about abstract rights.
I'm not sure. I mean, I understand Richard's argument, or I think I understand Richard's argument, but I do have some sympathy for what Mike's saying. I don't see what the harm is in saying, as far as we're concerned, human beings, every human being has the right not to be tortured, has the right, just by virtue of being a human being, we are saying that there are certain rights that should be recognized, you know, not being killed in a war, not getting raped, not getting, you know, all these kind of things. And that doesn't mean that we are then putting ourselves on a level field where we have to accept everybody else's definitions of rights. Why? We don't accept anyone else's definition of the word socialism. Why should we accept other people's definition of rights? You know, why? I don't really quite see why we can't say people have a right to eat. You know, if they're alive. I mean, rights derive from the consensus of the people, don't they? And I wouldn't mind betting if you went out and did a bit of market research and asked people, you know, do people have the right to eat? Do people have a right to shelter? This sort of thing. You would probably get an overwhelming number of yeses to that. Never mind how you define rights or the sort of moral rabbit hole of it all. You know, I don't really kind of see where's the harm in what Mike's saying. Why can't, not just saying people should have the right to speak, but people actually, by virtue of being human, we think, not everyone else does, but we think they have the right to eat, they have the right to all the things that Mike said. Can't really see the harm in that. Don't think that drags us into some terrible, debate where we have to sort of accept what lunatics on the right wing of the American Republican Party think.
Let me just throw my thumbs in first, Richard. You've said something there, Pai, that it sounds dead reasonable. And you'd like to say people have got a right to life, wouldn't you? But what would you say in the circumstance of if you get recalcitrant people opposing the socialist revolution that have got a lot of weapons? What would you say then? Would they have the right to life, or would we're not pacifist organization. We're not a non-violent organization. We wouldn't hesitate as socialists to take action against people that were threatening the socialist revolution by violent means. Yeah. So you're going a little bit towards, you'd be preventing that, on moral terms, I think.
Well, I don't really see that. I mean, I don't see why we have to talk in absolutes. I mean, you could make the case that human being has a right to life, although really what that means, I don't know. I think how Mike described it is more specific. They've got a right to eat. They've got a right to have not be homeless, these sort of things. This kind of idea of a right to life, well, you'd have to sort of qualify, wouldn't you? If somebody is about to murder you, have they got a right to life that overrides yours? Well, no, not really, no. This is the sort of, as soon as you start expressing it in these absolute terms, the whole debate becomes a bit sort of futile, but which is what
Richard was warning against.
But I don't really see why the statements that Mike wanted to make, I don't really see the harm in those statements. And as I say, I don't think that then commits us to respecting other rights, however lunatic, that other people want to put forward. Why?
It's not about respecting them, Paddy. It's not about sort of that commits us to other kinds of rights. Rights are a generally understood concept. If you accept the general concept of a right, if you say that we have, that people have the right to be fed and people have the right to sort of a decent life, people could just say, well, we have the right to property, and then you're in the same situation as you are with morality that you were arguing against earlier. You get into a situation where it's so vague. One man's morality is as good as anybody else's. One man's right is as good as anybody else's, because there is no grounding for it. There is no justification for this concept. It doesn't exist anywhere. It's just people feel that that people have this right. And once you base it on what people feel, then you're beginning to get into a really, really complicated argument. We don't need the concept of a right. As I said earlier, I absolutely agree with Mike. We can say, we want people to have food. We want people to have shelter. We want people to have a genuine right. Or even if you want to push it, we want them to have this right. That's a material right, which society gives to them, But to say people have a right in the abstract, whether they have it as a material, as if they actually are given it or not. It only becomes a real thing if somebody gives it to them. And then there's the question, who gives it to them and who has the power to give it to them? These become really complex questions. And as I was saying, they're unnecessary because we can make the same claims without reference to the word right at all.
Well, I accept that, and also I don't use the language of rights myself when things that I do, but I do accept that. But I mean, I just consider for a minute what would happen if the ideas of the SPGB, the WSM, light a blue touch paper amongst the working class. The very thing that we want to happen more than anything is for the working class to suddenly get the idea of socialism in a big way. And the first thing that would happen is that the SPGB, I can't imagine the world's working class joining the world socialist movement. That's just me. I think that they would, the working class would develop some new organization that was bigger, up to date, probably not as rule bound and as we are and all that sort of things. But I think that our little group would lose control of that organization immediately, and we would, you know, we'd be one voice in it. But I can imagine that organization using the language that Mike was describing, because there's a certain oratorical power in them. There's a rhetorical power. And I think it's more to do with the rhetorical power than any sort of deep-seated moral conviction that there are these things called rights that exist in the infinity of the universe. You know, that's not how people use the term rights. They use it as a sort of rhetorical for effect. And that's how world's working class, I think, would talk when they were talking about socialism. We have a right to peace. We have a right to eat. We have a right to shelter. I think they will do that, whatever we say. And you know, taking due account of your caution, Richard, I think that this is not something that the world's working class will follow.
Steve, can I take you to task about something?
Yeah, please.
You refer to not being a non-violent organisation. I mean, that doesn't give a very correct impression, really, because the impression it gives is that we are a violent organization, which we obviously are not. I mean, you can hypothesize a situation whereby the majority of the world's population has decided it wants socialism and they're being opposed by some small violent minority, in which case, you know, the majority would have to do something about it. Would they have to use violence? We don't know. But I think it's could be a bit misleading to refer on that basis, on that hypothetical basis, to refer to the party as a non-violent say the party's not a non-violent organization. Maybe it's choice of words, I don't know.
It's a choice of words. It's that we're not a pacifist organization. We're not pacifist on moral grounds. That's what I'm trying to get across. Thank you for taking me to task. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I couldn't see it. I can't see that a recalcitrant minority would be in any position whatsoever to oppose us. But if it were to be the case, we wouldn't pussyfoot about. We'd sort them out. But yeah, I mean, it's just that we do need to differentiate ourselves from pacifism on a moral basis.
Sorry to take a little sidestep here, but when talking about minority, I think it's sort of important to distinguish between a numerical minority and a power minority. So for socialism to rise about, yes, it would need a numerical majority, but also need a power majority. Even in the capitalist world today, yes, the people in power are numerically very much a minority, but they hold the vast majority of power, the means of production, of course. So it's not really about morality or ethics, but I think it's an important distinction that we need to bear in mind.
Well, they've got the ideological majority, haven't they? And they've also got the ideological means of production as well, which is the big advantage that they've got over us.
Yeah, you're right about that, Peter. But there are very few of them, and they hold the power. But they hold the power largely because the majority think it's okay that they should hold the power. The majority, in one way or the other, support them or don't oppose them. That's the problem. Once the majority cease to support them, even if they sort of held the power in terms of, I don't know, weapons or whatever, they'd find it very, very difficult. This would be our argument, I think, anyway. they'd find it very, very difficult to actually exercise that power, given the, you know, the power that the majority would have to prevent them from doing so, you know, to stop cooperating with the system, etc.
Has anybody been cheered up today by the Barbados government that they're intending to ditch the Queen as the head of state? I think this is really good news because it should we should make something of this, because it just shows that the power is in the heads of the people that accept that the other person is in power. Or am I being a bit too optimistic?
Much too optimistic.
Yeah, sorry, Steve. They're just going to transfer their assumption of power onto somebody else.
Yeah, they'll just have another set of leaders, won't they? They certainly, these new set of leaders certainly won't be opposed to capitalism, will they? I mean, it's
being a bit flippant, but the thing is, I mean, this is this wonderful monarch that suddenly she hasn't got that power. You know, let's hope that puts ideas into people's minds about other things.
Yeah, but the trouble is we're not hearing from the Barbados people that there's no talk of ideas that we put across. I mean, so, but I understand what you're saying though, Steve.
A leader can only be a leader if people agree to them being a leader. Simple as that.
I think what's cheered me up lately is what I mentioned earlier, the situation in Belarus. I mean, that guy, Lukashenko, he's basically given himself dictator powers for something like the last 28 years. And, you know, What's changed in the last 28 years? Well, one thing that's changed is social media has come along. I remember years and years ago, an old party member who was in Moscow, during the Cold War, said that, he was sat in a bar. This is Steve Coleman, by the way. He said he was sat in a bar and, some dock workers were eating breakfast or something and watching the news on the state news channel, which was TASS, and they were watching it and they were laughing and about the programs, and he actually asked one of them what they were laughing at. I'm not sure how good his Russian was, but he was asking what they were laughing at, and they went, "You don't think we believe this bollocks, do you?" And he told that story because of course he did think that they believed that bollocks, because he assumed that all Russians believe that bollocks because they didn't have any way not to believe that bollocks. That was before the age of social media. Now, a dictatorship like Belarus looks in serious danger of collapsing. And I've just been reading a big Economist article about Putin that thinks that his regime is coming apart at the seams as well, all because of social discontent and this idea that we will not be treated like this by these dictators. Again, this comes back to this idea of the real world and its kind of the emotional dissonance you have with it when all the films always end happily and the bad guy loses and the good guy wins, and that's not what real life's like, and people hate that, and they hate that in Belarus and they hate that in Russia and they hate that in other countries as well. But now they've got something that they can use. They've got social media. You've seen that we saw last year in Sudan, they overturned a dictatorship by using social media, and when the government troops opened fire on the demonstrators, they all filmed it and then sent them around the world, and BBC screened it all. More and more, I think, workers are sort of harnessing the power of social media, and you're seeing the power of mass protest in a way that it's spontaneous and it's hard for governments to stop. So those are things that I think are more encouraging. I couldn't care less about what head of state they have in Barbados or Jamaica or wherever it is.